And welcome to a special edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and our guest today is Pulitzer Prize winner Rick Bragg. He's a former reporter and bureau chief for the New York Times. He's written biographies of notable Americans Jessica Lynch and Jerry Lee Lewis. He might be best known for writing about his family's history in best-selling books, including All Over But the Shouting and Ava's Man. Today we'll be talking about his latest book, which looks at the role that food and cooking took in his family, going back to before the Depression. The book is called The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table, which is published by Knopf. Now, Rick, for some reason, I thought this was going to be a recipe book, and there are recipes in it, but it's more like the ratio of pork in a mess of greens.
Yeah, it's a narrative. You know, it's a real book, and it goes back of more than 100 years to, you know, the start of our food. And it tells that story. But yeah, there's some recipes in there. I don't know how scientific necessarily they are. But we wanted to tell the story of the food with all the color and drama and the fightings and shootings and loving and marrying and, you know, all that life, but with the food that bolstered it, you know, that held it up. And, yeah, I had fun on this one.
Are the stories, are they just the way they were told to you, or have you added your own salt pork for embellishment?
Well, there's always going to be fourth hand. There's going to be an embellishment down the line. But, no, we tried to stick. Because the thing is, there's not any point in adding more salt to something that's salted enough. And my favorite stories were like third hand from my aunts talking about their grandparents. But some of them were from my own childhood. Some of them were from sleeping at the foot of my grandma's bed. But most of them were sitting with my mom and my Aunt Juanita, talking to my Uncle Bill and my Uncle Jimbo at, like, family reunions and just gathering string all these years. You know, in newspapers, there's a term called, you do the dog's breakfast. And what they mean by that is all those things you wanted to get in to the main story that you're crafting. And there just wasn't a place. The tangent was too long, you know. Well, food has always been that in my books. It's always been a road too far to go down and get back. And we have food, you know, throughout my books. But this was my chance to make the food the road itself. And that's kind of what I did. But I started with the story. And then every Southern story is going to lead to food. You know, if we talk about the hog, Big Hog, when they're moving in the dead of night to beat the landlord, you know, and it kills itself running into the steel bumper of the truck in the dead of night. So they, or as my mama said, it suicided itself. And the story of that pitch black butchering, you know, in the middle of the night, of course you're going to ask, well, what'd you eat? And she said, well, you know, Mama had to cook the liver first because, you know, the liver goes bad. You know, no refrigeration then. Well, I didn't want to put a hog liver recipe in this book. Nobody likes hog liver.
But if it was cooked by your mama, you said,
well,
people like it.
Well, that's because of the gravy quotient. But, you know, you push it further, you know. But there's always a treat whenever there is a monumental thing in our family. And the treat was supper. And it was hot biscuits with butter beans, slow cooked with big fatty pork spare ribs. I mean, for hours and hours and hours till the spare ribs kind of melt into the butter beans. And, you know, I'd eat that right now.
Now, you're talking about how the road always wanted to go to food, but you always had to pull yourself back.
Right.
It seems like in fiction, particularly, unless the book is about people cooking,
right,
we don't mention food even in fiction.
Right. Well, I guess they think it's not dramatic. But they'd never been to a really good family reunion where you had three fist fights and a proposal and, you know, and maybe a little bloodletting. Well, when I started this book, I didn't even have the story about my great-grandfather, Jimmy Jim, the one that was hiding out in Georgia, the mean old felon.
Why was he hiding out?
He was hiding out because he had been involved in a... And there's no point in mincing words on it. I mean, he'd involved in a cutting fight with a man at the Mill Branch, which was a kind of a beautiful little stream. But people out in the country would gather almost like a park. They would bring you know, foot-long hot dogs and sandwiches. And they bring a little Pabst Blue Ribbon or, you know, sometimes a little white liquor and a bunch of Coca-Colas. And they would, you know, put them in that cold water and not the hot dogs, of course. And they would have a little picnic on the hood of the cars and they'd turn the radio to like Hank Williams. And, you know, just a great way to while away a little life. But at night, the hard drinkers kind of took over there. And my grandfather got involved in a cutting fight with a stranger. And, well, the story is that he killed him and had to flee. And he fled. And he left and went across the state line into the mountains of North Georgia. And it's not far, but it's a state line. And basically he hid out. And he lived the only way he could live, which was, you know, he trapped. And don't think Jeremiah Johnson here. You know, he had muskrat traps and, you know, he trapped, you know, had fish traps and turtle traps. And he lived fine. All he needed was a little cornmeal. But he hid out. And when my grandfather, Charlie Bundram from Ava's Man, book Ava's Man, when he married my grandma, he did so under false pretenses, not his but hers. She provided a box supper at a dance, and you know the men would bid on that box of food and would, you know, get the company for a dance or two with the young lady. And it was a lie. Her sisters cooked chicken and pie and made this great meal. Well, it wasn't her cooking. They just wanted to get her out of the house. She was peculiar. So he bids a dollar, which is a lot then. You know, they get married, and she can't cook at all. She'd make vegetable soup with no salt. She would make biscuits that rose only as big as a vanilla wafer, and cornbread that was like a tar paper shingle, and then would preach to him when he would complain of the benefits of unleavened bread from, you know, the New Testament. And those two stories collided when my grandfather realized that he was starving to death.
Well, she wouldn't even let him cook. She got offended if
he tried. She was offended. And she was offended if he tried to get help. He would get cousins, aunts, and even great aunts and have them come and stay a few days. People did that then. And they would try to teach her to cook. But she was so strong-willed and so hard-headed and a little peculiar, she would run them off, and they would leave literally either cursing or muttering about how willful the child was. So in desperation, my grandfather thought, who do I know that's a good cook, maybe even a great cook, that can stand up to this woman? He thought of his father.
So we got Taming of the Shrew with cooking lessons.
Exactly. He got his dad. No one had gone looking for him when he left. He was a furious, difficult, kind of quiet, and he'd been a stern taskmaster as a father. So everyone kind of made a compromise here. My grandfather got on a gray mule. My mama wanted me to understand it was a gray mule. Got on a gray mule, rode into those mountains in North Georgia, found his father, which was probably not as easy as it sounds, and came riding up to his shack. As it was described, his overalls hung on him like cross broom handles. He was not emaciated, but he was thin. And his dad said something about that when he came riding up, and I love this quote. "Yes, I am, Daddy, for I have married a pretty woman who cannot cook, and I am starving to death." That's the way they talked then. And his daddy took pity on him, and risking everything, rode back down the mountain with him and at least tried to commence to teach his daughter-in-law, who he never met, how to cook. It didn't necessarily go well right away. There was a lot of bloodshed. But the good thing was, no one seemed to care about the man who had mysteriously disappeared. And, you know, in the Deep South in those days, if you weren't somebody's cousin, then who's going to complain?
Well, also, you'd said the family moved around a bit. Were they still living in the same area where the crime had taken place?
They always lived in the same rough area, but they might be 50 miles away or 40 miles away.
That's a long time back then.
Yeah.
That's a long ways to go.
Yeah, and my grandfather never really liked landlords. he had always been a working man. Now, he did make some liquor for about 30 years or so, but he was mostly, when he wasn't making that liquor, he swung a hammer or he dug wells, you know. And he had worked at the steel mill briefly during the Depression, but the Depression took care of that job, which was the only indoor job he'd ever had. If you get in trouble and if you can make it across the state line, you're probably going to be all right. And I don't always like it when people write about the South in cliches, but there was probably a limit to how hard anyone would try to find you if you went up in those deep mountains. There's the foothills where I'm from, but you cross that Georgia line and you go north a little bit, it gets a good bit higher and a good bit scarier.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways to die out there just from not just from a mean man.
Right. I mean, of course, wild hogs figure into the book. And I can only imagine riding through those dark trails back then. Now billionaires have got vacation homes up in there, but riding through those mountains, you know.
Still might be a panther or a bear up there somewhere.
Well, I know there are some little, we have them down in my part of the state. You'll see a little, we call them honey bears, a little bitty black bear every now and then, and it just thrills you, you know. It's like hearing what you think might be a panther, or you know, and of course the biologists tell us that's not possible. But we have bobcats on my mom's.
Well, there's panthers making their way to Middle Tennessee.
Yeah,
so
think about it. Yeah, so, you know, it's still pretty wild up in there. But, you know, the South has just changed so much. You know, now if you want to go turkey hunting, you can just shoot one from your bathroom window in your backyard. You know, they will come walking up. But at that time, it was a different world. It was wild. And this little drama played out in, you know, a two-room sharecropper's house, you know, a rented house. And my grandpa did not like landlords. I mean, he had that dislike of them the way that I believe the Irish and the Scottish herders and had of the landlord. So they would just, the end of the month, and sometimes you'd push it because you could be a month behind. It's not something to be proud of, but they would just take to the road. They'd just load everything up.
In the middle of the night.
That's right. And go. And hope you got as many chickens as you thought you had.
If there was anything that kind of tied the recipes and the cooking together, it's you had to pay attention. You couldn't just wander off right while you were cooking stuff.
Right.
And so how does a woman who's got 6, 7 toe-headed kids running around keep focused enough to make the cooking good?
I think it's with great difficulty, with great difficulty. I remember when she was rendering lard. A lot of people think that, you know, you render lard to get cracklings. No, you render lard to get lard. You know, you cook down your pork fat to get lard. And the cracklings are just this wonderful extra, you know, this wonderful bounty. But it's deadly dangerous. I mean, a big roiling pot.
Of hot oil.
Yeah, imagine a witch's pot. You know, that was kind of, that's what I pictured it in my mind. And you ask about how the stories would change or how they would shift over time and in the telling, a lot of times you have to use common sense. And like, I knew what my grandmother wore. I knew what her hair looked like. I knew that she wore her dresses down to the tops of those old-fashioned button-up shoes. And so when I described her using that giant ladle to stir that bubbling hot oil, of course, I thought of, you know, Hansel and Gretel and, you know, the witches, you know, all that black hair she had that she didn't cut because she was Congregational Holiness. She was a Pentecostal, just, you know, blowing in the wind. So that's where a lot of the imagery comes from, is taking what you know and then just, you know, building the scene from the information that you have. But, yeah, could you imagine a pot is, you know, as big as a Fiat, and all these children running, throwing rocks and screaming and making mud pies. So she would take a stick and she would draw a line in the dirt. And the boys, who were barely human, and they were so wild, they were barely of this species, she would just say, okay, you can't cross this line. And she would probably have to, like, throw a rock or two at them because they were rough boys. But the little girls were better behaved, and they would, except maybe my Aunt Juanita. It's kind of like pointing to a road and saying, don't go in the road. It was that dangerous. But yeah, I'm sure she did a lot of death-defying things with holding a baby on one hip. It's kind of like, you know, how they didn't ride with seat belts. I'm sure she did a lot of, I'm sure she fried a lot of pork chops holding a child in one hand, you know. But it was the time.
Now, when you told your mama that the book was going to be called The Best Cook in the World, she was a little bit skeptical of the title.
Skeptical and more than a little bit, not angry. She never really gets that way too much at me anymore, but she was afraid that it would be seen as boasting. And mama has that odd mix of working woman's humility, but that rigid pride in her craft and in her food. But she didn't want me to, you know, to just puff my chest out and say, my mama is the best cook in the world. I never will forget. She said, what you gonna call it? And I told her the title, and she said, I wasn't even the best cook. It lived on our road.
Third best, I think she said.
Yeah, and I told her, I said, she said, you know, my mama was a good cook, and my sister Edna and my Aunt Edna was a great cook. But I told her, I said, Mama, calling it the third best cook on the Roy Webb Road does not sing. And besides, you know, I get to say, yes, my book about you, you're my mama, and I think you're the best cook in the world. And the bottom line in all this is, what meal would I have if I could have one? You know, if I could have one for the rest of my life, and it'd be hers, and one of probably a half dozen of hers.
It's amazing what we grow up with, how much it sticks with us for the rest of our lives.
Right, right. I remember being in Los Angeles, and I couldn't get home on a Christmas. So I went to the Ralph supermarket, and I got all the makings for a Christmas dinner. And again, I'm not a cook, but I got a ham. I got pinto beans. I got onions to make creamed onions. And I think I even tried to make dressing, you know, a cornbread dressing. And, oh, my God, it was a miserable effort. But the pinto beans and ham I figured I could do, because all you really got to do is, you know, boil the beans slowly over a few hours, salt. Not a lot of salt, because you're going to use the fat trimmings from the ham. And you don't use a little bit of ham, you use a lot of ham. I mean, every big spoonful of pinto beans should have big chunks of fat ham. And, you know, at the end of the cooking process, there should be this clear or translucent nectar on top of the pinto beans from all that ham fat and the broth itself from the beans. And mine just didn't look like that. You know, they didn't look like that. They weren't bad. They were still pretty good. It's hard to mess up ham fat. But it wasn't hers. So there is some magic in it, some alchemy in it. I grilled her as much as you can grill your mama. I couldn't find the gap, you know. But yet, again, they were still pretty good. I mean, there weren't any left. So just a biscuit, you know, a biscuit with some butter and some muscadine jelly, it's so much better than meals that I paid $100 for, you know, somewhere else in the world. It just is.
In the book, there are so many people. It's just not the auteur theory of cooking.
Mm-mm.
It's people sharing their techniques and their knowledge and their wisdom with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you show people that you care about
them. Well, you know, like, for instance, my grandma. You do an awful lot of making up and catching up when you get into your 50s. My grandma passed away while I was on the road living in New York and Los Angeles and Miami, and she passed away while I was very far away, and I was trying to make my living and build some kind of reputation as a writer. And I saw her every time I went home, but I didn't see her enough. So this was one more chance to, you know, bring her back to life in the way a writer does, not in it's a woefully disappointing way if you remembered her in life. But it's the best you can do as a writer. It's the best you can do. And, you know, bringing her back to life through her tea cakes, you know, and how she would put them warm in a pillowcase or a flour sack and hang them on a nail so that everybody who walked through could reach and get one and not even break stride. And it seemed like we always walked around with one hand because we were munching on a tea cake with the other one. You know, maybe a little bit crispy on the borders where it turned dark brown, but in the mound, the soft mound in the middle, just dead, perfect, soft. You know, sometimes she'd give us a little thing of butter and we'd put a little pat of butter on them. And so it gave me a chance to bring her as much as I can, as good as I can, you know, bring her back into the specter of the living for a little while. And you know, my mom is still with us, and she's cooking somewhere right now. But I don't think I could have stood to do it if I'd lost my mom. I don't think I could have done this book. I think it would have been too painful to do. So I had this wonderful chance to go back in time with my mom and bring back the young woman, you know, learning to cook. And some people I didn't really know. I got to make them walk and talk again. That's just a whole lot more fun than I ever believed it would be. Some of it's sad, you know, but a lot more fun. I'm sorry I didn't mean to rattle on about that.
Well, that's what we're here for.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, good.
Folks outside the South kind of think of us as just one big place.
Right.
And regional variation is extreme. Mm-hmm. And because I remember you mentioned in the book that you only had rice maybe for a dessert, like a rice pudding or something, over in Arkansas, mm-hmm. where we grow lots of rice. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had that just as often for breakfast as we mm-hmm. would for grits. Mm-hmm. So what about the Coosa River area do you think is unique and sets it apart from other parts of the South?
Well, that's a good point. I think the Mountain South, it is more a diet of the Mountain South. It would be have more in common with the Smokies. Right where I live is the foothills. I was born in a hospital called Piedmont Hospital, and it is where the mountains begin to flatten out. The highest point in our state is very near where I grew up, but then after that, it flattens out toward Montgomery, and you get the river delta towns, and that, you know, it's hotter, you know, the air is thicker. And it really changes. And so does the diet. Now you have rice. You have a lot more things like in South Alabama. You have crawfish. You know, you have a fish is much more a part of the diet. Where I came from, in part because it was, again, it was working class folks. Lot of taters. You ate a lot of taters. In part because taters were cheap. Lot of sweet potatoes, which are, I consider, one of the greatest inventions of all nature, and pork. You know, pork, not so much as that North Carolina image of someone spinning
whole hog,
but pork as a seasoning and essentially everything. Good example, red eye gravy. Now, a lot of places claim they have red eye gravy. But in my part of the world, this was the dish you ate red eye gravy with. You had to get a fresh tomato. You couldn't have one of them pink things. But a dead ripe, medium-sized tomato. Dice it, or don't really dice it, chop it, and set it aside. You can leave the skin on. Bake a pan of biscuits. Fry some of that lustrous ham steak, or just any center cut ham slice with a little bone in the middle with the marrow inside. That marrow inside that disc of bone might possibly be the best taste in the world. But you fry that up, set it aside in that, I guess a chef would call it oil or fat, but we'll call it what it is, in that meat grease. While it is still spitting hot, you add an equal measure, and it doesn't matter if you've got an eighth of an inch of the stuff or a fourth of an inch, add an equal measure of brewed coffee. And you won't have like a quart of it, but you'll have a small amount of this coffee and the hot meat grease and the bits of cooked meat down in the bottom of the skillet will blend. And then you open that hot biscuit up, put that mound of tomato on top of it, and pour or spoon, ladle, about 4 tablespoons, 3 to 4 tablespoons of that red eye gravy, and it trickles down through that tomato. You know, it trickles down through it, and it, because it's so hot, it wilts the thing, and it collects in that biscuit in the bottom. And then you salt and pepper to taste. Not a lot of salt, because, you know, the ham had some salt in it. I can't even really explain why it's good. The texture is a little strange, because the gravy is not a cream gravy. It's a thin, but the taste, that smoky taste, is unlike anything I've ever had. So inventions like this, I think, came from necessity. What did you always have? Well, in summer, you always had tomatoes, if you were lucky. And you always had some kind of pork somewhere. And if you don't have ham, you can do it with fat back. My mama likes to do it with, we call it white meat. Not streakaline, but pure white, that you cook so crisp that it just crumbles when you touch it. And, you know, that and 2 fried eggs and some grits and a little bit of ham. That's the kind of food that we ate some things that the Flatlanders ate, turtle soup. But our fish tended to be crappie, bass.
Brim.
Oh, a lot of brim. My mother is a brim-catching fool. She can just snatch them out of the water. Like, she didn't even use a reel. She just...
Cane pole.
And it's like watching some kind of great artist at work. She snatches them out, gets them off the hook, puts them on a tree branch for a stringer, and goes back to it, you know. Red wigglers. My brother's a great fisherman. I'm the worst fisherman in the history of man. Our fish is almost always fried. It would be wrong to say that everything is like a big hunk of pork or a big hunk of meat.
There'd be a lot of meals where, I mean, just that little bit of pork that was in the greens was all you had.
That was it. And that was fine. Yesterday, I had a lunch. A chef at a bookstore in Mississippi cooked collards, which were real good. I love collards. I love the dense nature of collards. You know, the not mushy green, but the dense, leafy green. I sounded like a chef there for a minute, didn't I? Gosh, I need to try to cultivate that. But that, some pinto beans. Pinto beans were fine, but they didn't have that excess of ham, that wonderful taste of ham. Cornbread muffin. He made a little turtle soup. And he made it to the recipe of the one that we use, which is more like a good vegetable soup or a Brunswick stew, but with turtle as the base, than the New Orleans style and the flatland style, the coastal style, where it's rich with sherry, and it's kind of a thick, dark roux, and it doesn't really have a lot of... This had cabbage, potatoes, but it was good. It was really good. I think that's our... You know, a lot of fresh vegetables that we make unhealthy. You know, fried green tomatoes, sweet corn. Some people call it fried corn, but it's really, you know, stewed corn with a little butter and salt and black pepper.
A little butter. I don't know if that's the right adjective.
Well, you know, and I know that our idea of a little butter, it might be a little butter for us, but for other people, it would be sweet Lord God at the butter. You know, but...
You like a little corn with your butter?
Yeah, I do like a little... Listen, sweet corn with butter, salt, and pepper, maybe even a little bit of cayenne pepper, just a little bit on it, is one of my favorite things. I could eat a half bushel of, like, sweet corn. You know, it was just country. If I say it's just country food, that doesn't do it justice. But the pork more is a seasoning. Beef, rarely. You know, rarely did we have beef. I think there are only 2 or 3 real beef recipes in there. And then they tend to be mostly meatloaf, you know, hamburger. The most succulent recipe in there is probably beef short ribs, you know, potatoes and onions. No seafood. We never had shrimp. The first shrimp I ever ate, I spit it out. The first oyster I ever ate, I spit it out because it was just unnatural and alien. We didn't have any of that. We didn't have... There were mussels up on the Tennessee River, and my grandpa would gather mussels. You know, it was what you could grow, what you could raise in a small pen, because only rich men had cattle. you had a milk cow, but only rich men really had cattle.
I remember once when I was a kid, my dad and my stepmother would eat dinner in the living room, watch Wheel of Fortune.
Sure, sure.
And me and my two stepsisters would eat in the dining area. Mm-hmm. And Friday night, I had a piece of steak on my dish, and I went, oh, I'm looking forward to this. So I cut into it, and I eat it, and I just shriveled up my face. And I had another piece of it, and it just, oh man, this is off. And I go in the living room, and I said, you know, I want to thank you all for giving a steak this evening, but I think it's gone bad. There's something wrong with it. Well, that's because it's liver, you dumbass.
Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. Yeah, I'm sorry. Beef, pork liver, either one of them. Now, I love chicken liver. And to be honest, I can eat liver with enough of the gravy quotient. Enough gravy and onion, you can probably eat a shingle. Fried chicken liver's coleslaw and maybe some green beans or mashed potatoes. That's a reason to live.
Well, I like to know that I came by my dislike of liver honest.
No,
that it just wasn't the word that turned me off. It was the actual taste.
Yeah, well, first of all, it was just cruel. It was almost child abuse. You know, it was just cruel. I eat a lot of things that may sound exotic, and exotic only in a kind of a blue-collar way. But, you know, I love beef tripe. You know, tripe, you know, the stomach lining. I love that stuff. Mama makes it with, you know, white gravy and biscuits. We have eaten some brains and eggs, but I'm not wild about the brain tastes metallic.
I just didn't like the texture of calf's brains.
Yeah, yeah,
They're just so spongy.
Yeah,
the taste was all right. I had it in a soup, and it was all right. But the texture, it's just like chewing on fat.
Well, I mean, you know, for instance, chitlins. You know, I lovingly write about cracklins, which is just rendered pork fat. And maybe if you're going to boil down, or that's a poor choice of words, or fry down to an essence, the taste of Southern cooking, I think that nugget of pork fat, a cracklin, a pork cracklin, you know, maybe mixed with cornbread and baked, maybe as good as it gets. As far as I used to sit in a parking lot down in Louisiana and buy a bag of them and eat them like M&Ms. But that cracklin is a noble, beautiful thing. Chitlins? My mama doesn't like chitlins because she knows what they were designed to do. And there is just now this is just me, and great chitlin cooks, you know, would want to fight me over this. But I just can't get beyond the texture I can handle, but I just can't get beyond the notion. You know, it's the notion. And I've had them. You know, I've had them many, many, many times. I like, you know, chicken backs, and I love pig's feet. I mean, pig's feet are one of the great delicacies of all time. You know, that gelatinous, fatty, delicious. Even the tiny little bit of lean in a pig's foot is just melts in your mouth. So I like the old food of my people. You can take pig's feet, split them, line them up in a pan, rub them down with a little oil, salt and pepper them a bit, put some cayenne pepper on them, and you can even put some thin tomato-based barbecue sauce on them and just bake them. And when they come out, it's something that it's just a shame that you're just not allowed to, like, take the shower curtain off the thing, put it around your neck and eat them that way, because you just can't stop eating them. You know, they're just so good. I love that. But there's some stuff that's just too exotic for me. I don't like raccoon. It tastes like what I imagined bear would taste like. I haven't eaten
it. I've heard both are real greasy.
Yeah, it's not good. Possum to me, I know it's healthy, but...
But your Aunt Juanita loves it.
Well, my Aunt Juanita thinks that possum perhaps delivered her from death. She was really sick. She had had ulcers, and terrible ulcers, and she had been eating a boiled fish, poached fish. My grandfather was a great fisherman, and that was the only thing she could kind of get some sustenance from. But she was really suffering. And I'm sure, I don't know what the medicinal properties of possum are. I doubt if they're quite as much as Aunt Juanita believed.
Well, possum eat a lot of ticks. Maybe it's that anticoagulant stuff that's in ticks. You know,
I might have gone the rest of my life and not thought about the tick quotient. But she had always liked them. So my grandma baked her a whole possum, you know, sweet potatoes and the whole bit. And she ate pretty much the whole thing. I think she said, I did save Mama a leg. And the next day she was up and moving around. I don't know of how much of that is lore and how much of it is, like I said, the medicinal property of a marsupial. But I've had it. I've had it more than once in my life. It is so oily and a little bit stringy that you would think it'd be terrible for you, but it's not. It's that good cholesterol. It's freakish. It's actually really great for you.
So it's like fish oil?
Yeah. And that's how I know sometimes that up in heaven people are messing with us. Because why would you make a spare rib so bad for you and make possum good for you? I just don't think that's fair.
Now, could you give us a little bit of a PSA on how to eat poke correctly so we don't kill our full selves?
Well, yes. In the eating of poke salad, the best rule of thumb is don't. Run in the other direction. But don't tell that to these old folks that have grown up on it. My mother got physically angry. Not she like beat me, but she got visibly angry at me two or three times in this book. And one of them was when I said, I don't think we're going to put poke salad in here because I think it's just a little obscure. You know, and she said, well, I don't know about obscure, but I know it's medicine. And when she was in the hospital, she doesn't love doctors. She refers to her dermatologist as Dr. Butcher. But she just doesn't like doctors. And so she's always ready. The minute she gets into a hospital, she's ready to go. And she just walked around grumbling one day in her room, wouldn't even sit down on the bed, saying, if they'll let me out of here, I'll go pick me some poke salad and I'll cure myself. And this is how you do it. Stay away from the root, which is toxic and deadly. Stay away from the stalk, which is toxic and deadly. Not as deadly as the taproot, but still deadly. Stay away from the berries. Don't eat it at all in the fall, late in the season, where the toxins in it intensify. So pick it young and only strip the leaves, only take the leaves. Even then, you should wear some kind of gloves because even then, the toxins in the plant can, you know, affect your hands, you know, can cause a rash. So you get yourself a big brown grocery bag at least because it cooks down to nothing.
Well, you're going to have to boil it a couple
times. Yeah, yeah. Well, first you're going to have to wash it three times. You get it, put it in a bowl, a clean bowl. Mama uses a big stainless steel bowl. And she rinses it, gets all the grit off the first time. Then she rinses it again, which I think maybe leaches some of the toxin out. And then she washes it again. And then she begins the boiling process. So you boil it down. You pour off the liquid, all of it. Then you boil it again. And sometimes you boil it again. And then you fry it. And by this point, the green, the deep green leaf, is pretty much black. It is the least appetizing looking plant on earth. And then you break an egg in it at the end and scramble that egg up. And I'm convinced they do that just so they can say that there's some food quotient to it. But Mama loves it. It tastes a little bit like spinach, you know. Again, there are some things that are just so much trouble to fix that it must be good. But don't tell her that it's not worth the risk.
Well, it's also something you go out in your backyard and you can get. You don't have to go to the store for it or anything.
Well, you know, and this is why I believe that my mother is so loyal to it, because it was ours. And I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to bang that drum. You know, life, the playing field in life has been even for a very, very long time. But when my mama was a little girl, poke salad was the last resort. It was the last resort. But, of course, they didn't just eat it as a last resort. But you could always get poke salad. It grew in pastures along a fence line. It was carried by the birds. The birds eat the berries. Some birds are immune to the toxins in the berries. They fly a little bit, and their droppings carry the seed. So you always have poke salad being sown on fence lines and pastures. Farmers don't like it because they don't want their cattle eating it. You have it in ditches. It particularly loves a septic tank, proving that this is a highbrow cookbook. But if I badmouth poke salad in front of my mom, it's like I badmouthed a favorite cousin. To this day, and my mom is, a little more frail now than she has ever been, but I'm not at all surprised to go driving down the Mark Green Road, which is where we live now, and see an old woman carrying a brown paper sack full of green leaves, and then look closer and that old woman be my mama. She considers it medicinal. It's good for the blood, she says, and it's got a lot of iron in it. And that is true, but it had to be some really fine vitamins to make up for all that.
Well, maybe it's kind of like chemo, and it's killing stuff in there.
Well, maybe so. I mean, these old women knew. They knew. Some of it was myth, like, if you had a bad cough, you could eat some spider webs. Some of it was myth. But most of it had some basis in fact. I don't have a lot of folk remedies in here because I think there is another arena for that. I wanted to hold it to food. But poke salad and possum might be the only cure-alls in the whole book.
Your family, especially during the Depression, had to live off the bounty of the land, and so much, and pretty much meal and flour and right. sugar would be the only thing you could buy at the store that you had to.
Right.
There did come the invention of government cheese, and to think that the federal government could be responsible for something that great.
Isn't it beautiful? I mean, it is just beautiful.
I had it back in the 80s growing when I lived with my grandma for a
while. Yeah, it is a beautiful invention. And all other American cheese. It was the least appetizing looking box. It was a big old loaf.
Yeah, it looked like a big old brick of Velveeta or
something. A big brick, but it was denser than American cheese that you buy. And it's nothing like the American cheese that you get in those cellophane. Mm-hmm. Nothing like that.
It's about halfway between American and cheddar.
Yeah, about halfway between American and cheddar. Mild but dense and had flavor. It had flavor to it. And my favorite story from then is people from the foothills would dress up to go to town on the day that they went to get their commodity cheese. The stigma of food surplus, it wasn't felt, I think, as deeply because there were so many people on it. So many people who got a few things, cheese, peanut butter. You could get
powdered milk.
You could get a canned chicken, but it was the peanut butter and you could get some meal, and you could sometimes get flour, but you could get this mystery meat that I think was probably Spam, which was delicious. Mama would cut it in circles and fry it. But the cheese was just a thing of beauty. And when she had to go and stand in line to get it, because my daddy was gone and, she had these children. She had this would have been in 59, she had my brother Sam, and she was picking cotton and taking in laundry and doing things like that to make a living. But she still got, they called it their commodities. And she would always dress up when she went to town to get her commodities, I think as a point of pride maybe. And a lot of the people would. She was pregnant with me, and she described in great detail the outfit she wore. She went and bought her one maternity outfit, had it made. And she remembered the pattern. And this is where the beauty of writing about family. She remembered the pattern of the shirt and the dress. And she, got in line to get her commodity cheese. And, I was about ready to arrive. The man passing out the cheese at the table put two blocks of cheese in her box. And he knew our family. He knew things had been bad. But that cheese was pretty tightly guarded, and Mother was terrified. First, she tried to get him to not take it, and he said, not give it to her. And he said, you're going to get me in trouble by doing this. Just take it and go on. You'd have to know my mom. It just horrified her. So she takes one log and the other commodities and puts it in my little brother Sam's wagon. He took a wagon everywhere. He went a little pull wagon. And then she cradled the other one in her arms, you know, and they kind of made a dash for the car. And they almost made it when an old woman saw her walking from behind carrying that big block of cheese like the precious thing it was. Let's put it this way. The first time anybody ever asked how I was, they thought I was a block of cheese or thought it was me, but we don't have time to work that out. But yeah, she would take that cheese. She would take a Pet Ritz pie shell. Mother believes in three or four modern inventions, self-rising flour and self-rising meal. She believes in them. And she believes in the Pet Ritz pie shell. And she would take that pie shell and brown it just a little bit. And she would put a thick mixture of, we'll call it tomato sauce, but it was ketchup, mustard, some spices maybe, you know, in the bottom of that shell. Then she would fry fresh pork sausage from these hogs that we always had. And she would sprinkle it, you know, about maybe a half inch thick on that bottom of that pie shell, on top of that tomato mixture. And then she would make a lattice work of thick strips of that commodity cheese. And just enough to let the, you know, the heat come through. And she would put it in the oven and bake it until the shell was crispy and the cheese had, some of it had melted down into the sausage mixture and some of it had begun to brown and crisp on the top. And she'd take that out of the oven and cut it into four pieces. I mean, imagine that for like a five-year-old boy or a six-year-old boy, you know. And she made it the other week, and I can't tell you it wasn't still very good. But for a kid, gosh, Amani. You
know. It's kind of like an eggless quiche or something.
Yeah, kind of like, you know, we called it pizzas or sausage pie. I think I called it sausage pie in the book. But I don't care if you called it mud pie. It was good. It was really good. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of commodity cheese, but I don't even know if it exists in the world anymore.
Now, I always heard of hoop cheese, and I'd see a sign up when it was on sale every once in a while, but I never did have it. What was hoop cheese like?
Hoop cheese was, you know, either black rind or red rind, usually. Sharp cheddar. And I mean, you know, it was as different from any kind of mild cheese as it could be. Sharp and dense.
But on the dry side,
a little bit crumbly. You know, not quite as crumbly as, say, maybe Parmesan. You didn't have to slice it off. You could just grab the end of it and break off a piece of it. And old men had ate it on the rivers. They would go get a block of hoop cheese and some saltine crackers and fish all day. You know, sometimes they would have an exotic lunch of hoop cheese and onions and saltine crackers and Viennese sausages. And sometimes the real old men would have sardines. I'm just not a sardine man. I can sit and eat that sharp cheddar, you know, by itself.
We'd have the sharp cheddar when I was a kid. I guess we were fancy enough. We didn't call it hoop cheese then. But we'd get a hot mustard and dill pickles.
Oh, yeah. I think that good sharp cheese might have saved my life one time. I was in Islamabad, Pakistan after 9/11. We had been eating an awful lot of goat dishes, you know, rice dishes, things like that. Yeah, there's a lot of okra over there, things like that. But it's cooked very, obviously very different. So you begin to pine a little bit for simple things. And one day a lady came in from London. She had flown through London and brought in, I don't know how she got those tomatoes in there, but brought in some good sharp cheese and crackers. And we had that and sliced red tomatoes, salted and peppered, and I think maybe some onion. I probably ate more cheese than is healthy for a human to eat. But no, to this day, the thing I love about on book tour sometimes, I'll stay in hotels that I would probably not stay in if it were me, because my reasons for staying in a hotel are different. I like to be able to move around. On book tour, you usually stay downtown. you know. And best thing about it is a lot of those fancy hotels have cheese, or as we call it, rich folks cheese. I've been selecting some rich folks cheese here lately.
Lived over in Hamburg in Germany for about a year and a half, and I'd go up to the they'd have a kind of like a farmer's market thing a couple times a week up on a square near where I lived. And I'd go there, and the cheesemonger knew I was from America. And he'd just laugh at me every time. He goes, "Y'all don't have cheese over there. Y'all got oil over there."
Right, right.
You know, he
petroleum
was always,
cheese.
But one day I picked up a hunk of that Limburger,
and
I almost never got that smell off my hands. Oh.
There is such a thing as too much cheese. And I think Limburger is just too much cheese for, you know, people used to say that about when I'd go shopping for a pickup truck, they would say, and, you know, they could tell by looking at me, I didn't really have any money. And they would say, I'll never forget, they say, "Son, you don't want to look at that truck. It's too much truck for you, boy." And I think Limburger is too much cheese for me.
I have to say I appreciate the way you spell mama, M-O-M-M-A, and not M-A-M-A.
Right.
Because I always thought M-A-M-A was mama.
Right, right.
And so I really appreciate mama with an O.
Well, you know, that goes back to conversations I had as a young man about just how it sounded, just like you said. I grew up trying to read, you know, I read The Three Musketeers, and I read the Tarzan books, and I read, you know, the Hardy Boys. And any traveling I did through books. And yeah, M-A-M-A was something more exotic, you know. Mama should be spelled M-O-M-M-A. That's how it sounds. And especially the way we say it. Listen to a child walking up to their mama with a bag of Fig Newtons or something in a store or some popsicles, and listen to how it sounds, especially in the South. And it is M-O-M-M-A. But started that with shouting, and have tried to do it consistently, you know, ever since then.
Did you have to fight for it at the beginning?
There was some discussion about it. There's always some discussion about some things. And quite frankly, I've lost as many as I've won of those discussions. We had to fight a little bit for All Over But the Shouting, for the name All Over But the Shouting, because some folks thought it was a bit obscure. But it was one of the last things my daddy said to me, you know, when he was alive, and I wanted it to be that. And it summed up our lives, you know, that we survived a lot at that point, and there, it was time to celebrate a little bit. But this one, there was just something about the sound of the best cook in the world in your ear, and I could just hear every friend I'd ever had, every stranger I ever met on book tour looking across the table at me and saying, "My mama was the best cook in the world." So in an unbiased arena, there's probably a better cook out there. We don't have to be that way. I get to say, and so she's the best cook in the world.
Now, we all experience heartbreak. Mm-hmm. I've had a couple of women tear out my heart and stomp on it right in front of me, and, of course, losing family members. And, but there is a unique heartbreak, I think, for us, especially in the South, is when you go to a family get-together, and for the first time, someone brings something from the Walmart bakery department.
That's the beginning of the decline of our civilization, I think, is when that happens. Now, you also have to take into consideration that maybe that person just pulled a double at the cotton mill. So, you know, I understand it. But yeah, at family reunions, my grandmother, Ava, on her birthday, June 14th, we always had
Flag Day.
We always had a dinner, a birthday dinner. And we usually had it under the water oak trees in the backyard. And the picnic tables that the men would drag out there would be sway back probably a little bit to begin with. But they would be covered in four or five kinds of potato salad, three or four kinds of baked beans, all homemade, all with that little burnt edge around them from where the brown sugar had adhered to that glass, thick slabs of bacon, you know, that had withered up a little bit on top, deviled eggs, two or three varieties. I remember the yolks would be different colors, barbecued pork chops and barbecued ham slices, chicken cooked more ways than you can even think about, And then there would be the blue collar, not just the picnic food, but the blue collar food. Big, big boilers full of corn and big boilers full of green beans and new potatoes. Big boilers full of pintos or white beans or lima beans or even butter beans. You know, someone would make a pan of dressing, even though it was the middle of the summer. There'd be baked chicken. And then the desserts would, not one of them came from a deli. Not one of them came from a grocery store. Big sheet cakes of strawberry shortcake. Not anything exotic, just a big yellow, you know, just big yellow slab of yellow cake mix with a whip top and frozen strawberries, you know, poured into holes that they'd made by poking their fingers into the, you know, jello pudding cake, you know, where you just make a yellow sheet cake and poke your finger down in the cake every few inches and, you know, fill the top with chocolate pudding. Pecan pies in summer, coconut pies, chocolate pies. Do you remember that candy that people made from cocoa and butter and sugar and oatmeal? You know, it was like a raw candy almost.
What, like no-bake cookies or?
Yeah, kind of like no-bake cookies, but it was mostly just oatmeal and cocoa, sugar and butter, and you didn't really cook them. You just put them in the refrigerator, mm-hmm. or let them set. I made myself hungry, and I've been booked tour 2 weeks. I made myself starve, but yeah, I mean, there was great effort in it. You know, pones of cornbread, cornbread muffins, biscuits that they would have covered over in, you know, dish towels, and 100 old women moving their hand back and forth and back and forth and back and forth to keep the flies off of it. Yeah, I understand why people do what they do. I eat a lot of fast food chicken. I eat a lot of fast food everything. You know, I get by. But that was a thing of beauty. It was a thing of time and attention and care. After my grandma passed, we kept doing it to honor her. And also, I think people just didn't want to turn loose of that tradition just yet. We had one not long ago where I gathered a great deal of information for this book, talking to my uncles on my mama's side. They were both still alive, Jimbo and my Uncle Bill, Wild Bill. And of course, they're both gone now. And the stories they both told were funny and heartbreaking, and in my Uncle Jimbo's case, certainly peppered with many lies. But at one point, he was telling me a story, and he said, "I got to get me some of that coconut cake." And he said, "I'll be right back." And he got up, he walked over to the table, and he started telling lies to somebody else. I didn't see him for 2 years. And I never got the end of the story. But the stories in the food were one and the same, I think. And I think that's maybe why this book has appeared to be working.
Now, talked about the birthday coming up on Flag Day, but you got a birthday coming up too. Was there any special cake or pie that came around every year for your birthday?
And, you know, it's funny. People have asked me what recipe didn't make the book. You know, the book's only 500 pages long. There's going to be a few left out. But my Aunt Jo, who is my mama's younger sister, made me every year, and continues to when her health allows, makes me a peanut butter cake. And not a layer cake, but again, like making it for a family reunion or a banquet, makes a big old yellow sheet cake with about a full inch of peanut butter icing on it. And the icing is light, and it's not sugary sweet, which fools you into thinking you can maybe eat a bigger slab of it. But it's so good that I have stood in the glow of my refrigerator at like 1:30 in the morning and eaten a slab of it and never got the door closed to the fridge. Just eat it there in the glow of the refrigerator. You know, it just dwindles, you know, the few days go by and it dwindles. But no one's ever lasted more than 3 days.
How does she get the peanut butter? Is it marshmallow fluff she mixes in it?
No, she it is, you know, if I had a recipe, I could tell you exactly how she gets it to do it. It's not a creamy chiffon-like but it's creamy, but it will set just the slightest bit, the way good caramel cake, you know, how it will set just a little and get a little bit
of crunch on
it. Yeah, just that little bit of crunch on it. But it must start out thin because it seems to leach just a bit into the cake layer so that it's always moist underneath that. I'm sure it ain't good for you, but I don't care. You know, it's just good. So that always usually get me a peanut butter cake. And my mama sometimes will make me a big, gigantic platter of deviled eggs. And what we'll do, we'll have barbecue and maybe ribs and deviled eggs. The one great problem with this book is Mama has gotten older. Her potato salad has transmogrified. What Calvin and Hobbes used to say.
Oh, yeah. The transmogrifier. Yeah,
and she used to make the best potato salad in the world. Now she likes a soupier, kind of a thinner potato salad, which, you know, I like a big, chunky, cold potato salad. And we sometimes even have it warm. And I don't have the guts to tell her that I don't really like that style. And I hope she's not listening to this, but that's like a dirty secret. I've got to like carry that to my grave. You know, I may not necessarily love my mama's potato salad. And, you know, I'm sorry, I don't need that burden. I don't need to carry that sin around with me.
Okay, you've got it off your chest.
I got it off my chest.
You put it into a place where she's never going to hear it.
But the one we use in the book was the old recipe, so the proverbial cat may be out of the proverbial bag. So you see me walking by here with a suitcase, you'll know what happened.
A little bindle over your shoulder.
Right, exactly.
I have to admit, I'm a bad Southerner because my ex-wife was German, and she made potato salad, a hot potato salad with some chicken broth on it and everything.
Mm.
That was real good. I like that a lot.
Now, I've had, you know, I lived a year up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and there was a place that had German potato salad every day. And I liked the texture of it. And I liked the fact that sometimes it had little bits of what seemed to be pork or bacon, you know, specking it here and there.
Well, German word for bacon is speck.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just best not to turn your nose up at anything till you've had it about eight times, you know, and I liked it.
Well, I have to say, Germans know their pork.
Yeah, they know their pork. A lot of the great sausage makers in the Deep South, a lot of them have links, you know, to Germany. It's a wonder we're not all walking around down here eating blood sausage, you know, or you know, that kind of thing.
I've given that a try in an Irish restaurant. I didn't care too much for it. No. White sausage I liked all right.
Yeah. But. Well, an Irish breakfast might be the... But it's just a Southern breakfast. All an Irish breakfast is that big old thick bacon, you know, a fried bread, which isn't any worse for you than a biscuit, I guess. And, you know, fried eggs and those tomatoes, you know, those baked tomatoes with a little cheese on top. I mean, they know how to eat a little bit of breakfast. And kept me alive over there for a while.
Well, I'll say that my grandma's cornbread, she made on top of the stove.
Hoe cakes, right?
Almost like... Well, not a hoe cake.
Yeah.
It was like one big one.
It was a pone. Yeah, it was
pone. And she'd flip it over. She'd almost use like an omelet skillet. She wouldn't use a cast iron for it. She'd flip it over, no sugar. And she always used white cornmeal. She didn't use any yellow in it.
Yeah.
And it was crunchy. And that's what cornbread is to me.
That sounds pretty good. Did she start with bacon grease or butter?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, probably both.
Well, no bacon grease.
Bacon grease.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty. Now, Mama does that. It's almost the same thing, only she does three big fat cakes of cornmeal. White cornmeal, no sugar, bacon grease, or lard, you know. And you get more crunch in it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she does when she has cornbread and buttermilk, which is one of the few things. It's kind of like chitlins. Now, I can eat cornbread and buttermilk and have, but my mama swears by it, you know. Just
my grandma just crumble it up in the milk, in the buttermilk.
That's all you do. And you know, some people like do it with sweet milk. A lot of older people who couldn't eat much else would eat like cornbread and sweet milk. It was easy on their systems. But cornbread and buttermilk, my mama sometimes would chop a little onion or stick a whole green onion down in there, and they'd eat it out of a glass. They'd eat it out of a coffee cup, you know. Or but if they're getting serious, yeah, they got them a bowl. Cornbread and buttermilk and vegetable soup, not together, but those two things will always be, you know, staples for us. You know, vegetable soup, you'd freeze it and eat it, you know, make it in the summer and eat it in November. And Mama cans it, you know, puts it up in cans and in jars, and it tastes just like it did, you know, when it was fresh. But, yeah, cornbread and buttermilk is an acquired taste, I think, for our generation.
Beyond the gloriousness that is chocolate gravy, my mom used to take canned peaches in the jar,
right,
stick them in the fridge, get super cold, bake a chocolate sheet cake,
mm-hmm,
put the peach halves on top, and then pour the peach juice all over that. And that was one of my favorite desserts.
Yeah. The things you can do with canned peaches. There's that great scene in a Steve McQueen movie, I think it's called Nevada Smith, where he is sitting on the step of a, you know, old Western town, and you know, everybody else is knocking down the doors to the saloon to get at the red eye. And he is sitting on the porch drinking the juice from a can of peaches, you know, and it still remains one of like those great things. And, you know, cans were no great sin in Southern cooking, you know, no refrigeration. What are you going to do? You're going to have cans. And yeah, you know, without peach cobbler, I don't know if we, you know, there is not a recipe for peach cobbler in there. There's blackberry and plum, things like that. But I should have had a peach cobbler recipe in there.
Blackberry is my favorite.
Yeah.
And I have to disagree with your mom. I like bottom crust.
Bottom crust?
Yeah.
Well, my grandma Velma, not my grandma Ava, but my grandma Velma, she had such a variety of deep dish pie. And that drop crust was, you know, at first I thought, well, that's just an easy way to do it. Well, it probably was an easy way. But it was also a way that you could work a shift at the cotton mill. You could work 10, 12 hours at cotton mill standing on an upside-down Coca-Cola box, trying not to let the machine get your fingers and your hair and your hem of your dress. You know, when you got home, sometimes you had to be not just a good Southern cook, but you had to be a quick one. I can still see that old woman getting those canned blackberries down off the shelf and adding that sugar and that butter and then making that kind of drop biscuit crust, but thinner, and then just pouring it over the top. So you can have a bottom crust. You just got to turn it upside down when you spoon it out on your plate. At really good Southern restaurants, if they've got a good blackberry cobbler, I think that's an acid test, you know, with a bottom crust and a rolled out top, you know, maybe that lattice work top. That's hard to beat.
That'd be my favorite dessert,
is
a blackberry cobbler.
Yeah, and I can eat it plain. I don't have to have anything on it. You know, I can eat it just plain.
So what you working on now?
Yeah. You know, the beautiful thing about, you know, it's funny thing about books. You can want to write a book, wanting to write a book and getting to write a book, even after all this time. And I've been doing this for a quarter century. It's not always the same thing. I've always been fortunate enough, lucky enough to get to write the ones I wanted to write. So I've never taken that for granted. And to have people actually like them and has been one of the great joys. But the book tour, how can you not like signing books for, you know, for people that like your books? How can you not like doing that? And if the hardest thing you have to do is talk about the book, this is fun to me. And it also helps me realize what people find in the book and what they see in it. And in line at a book signing or a book event, you know, believe me, 100 times before the sun goes down, somebody will say, "You stole that right out of my grandma's." And this one doesn't have the grit or the sadness that the other books had. There's some grit in it. There's, you know, there's funeral food, you know, in here. But it doesn't have the blood and the grit and the sadness that some of the others had. Not that they were the wild bunch, but they were a little harder on the heart, I think, in some places. This one has been a joy to tour because, you know, it's just, we're talking about food, and usually food makes people smile. But unfortunately, I found that on the book tour for this one, we'll do New York and D.C. later in the month, but mostly in the South where I've been just lately, people walk up and they're just crying, they're just sobbing. And it's not because of necessarily any line you wrote. It's that it evoked a memory of a grandma or a mother or a sister you know, their best cook in the world. And it's drawn out that memory, and that person's gone. And they say over and over and over again, I didn't write it down. Yeah, we just didn't write it down. We didn't write it down. We just figured it was there somewhere. Well, it's not. I hope people try this. I even hope the Yankees try it. I hope they try it up in, as I said, I hope they try it in San Francisco, and I hope they try it on the Upper East Side. I hope they do. But I hope they try it on them $10,000 stoves, the one that you can write War and Peace on the keypad, you know.
Oh, but, I mean, the Vikings are made down in Mississippi.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely. So I hope people try it. But I made sure I put it in the introduction. I hope that somebody in a little wood frame house in North Alabama or this corner of Tennessee or Mississippi or Georgia, I hope that they, you know, in some wood frame house or in a double wide, or in that two-bedroom brick rancher with a redwood deck, I hope they look at it and say, you know, my grandma made that. You know, my grandma made it just like that. Or, even better, my grandma didn't make it like that. She made it this way. Mm-hmm. And that has already happened a good bit.
Oh, yeah. I was reading along going, no, that, nope, nope, nope.
Nope,
in our parts.
Yeah. and if, you know, thank goodness dueling has been outlawed in most places, except perhaps parts of Mississippi. Now, Jerry Lee's still down in Mississippi, so they might have reinstituted that. But thank God dueling is not, because I am sure that some of the claims in this book of my mama's superiority, there's probably a rough old boy or two out there that would asked me to step out to the sandbar.
Well, he would have to read the book in the first
place.
Well,
that's true.
Did you hear about this fellow down in Tuscaloosa who was talking about his mom?
I had a guy one time actually at a book signing in my hometown. One of my cousins came up and said, Rick, you can't do your book signing. Your cousin, I ain't going to give you his name, but cousin so-and-so, he's going around town telling everybody that if you show up in town, he's going to cut you. And I thought, has that ever happened in the history of being an author that didn't involve maybe Salman Rushdie? Has that ever happened that you write a book, you go back to your hometown, and you have to keep a close eye out on this third cousin because he's threatened to cut you? And at least this will be better than that.
Rick, I want to thank you so much for coming by today. It has been a pleasure and a half.
It is always a pleasure. I hope we keep doing it until we have to stagger in here.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
Rick Bragg is the author of The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table, which is published by Knopf. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.